Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In this topsy-turvy world, we remain a rock of stability. Two guests, two segments. Mouin Rabbani will tell us what this spate of diplomatic recognitions of Palestine means, and Ernesto Samán will examine the political and economic crisis in Argentina, whose libertarian president Javier Milei is in line for a U.S. government bailout. First, Palestine. In the last week, 10 countries, among them Canada, Britain, and France, have recognized Palestine, a state that does not yet exist. Israel is not happy. Here to explore what it all means is frequent Behind the News guest Mouin Rabbani. Mouin has served in several diplomatic roles over the years and is co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine that covers the Middle East. Mouin Rabbani. So we've seen a spate of recognitions, I believe 10 in the last week or so, of the Palestinian state, which doesn't exist. What do these recognitions mean precisely?
We should first of all place them in their historical context. The Palestinians declared statehood in November of 1988, and by the end of the 1980s, most of the international community had already recognized the state of Palestine. With the exception of Sweden in 2014, no Western state had yet recognized Palestine. That began to change last year, when Norway, Ireland, and Spain, followed by Slovenia and one or two others, began to recognize Palestine. And then it's really in the last week or so that the dam burst. You had two members of the UN Security Council, members of the G7, one of them a leading member of the European Union, Britain and France recognizing Palestine, joined by Canada, Australia, provisionally by Belgium and a few others. So you now suddenly have Western states, including key Western states, recognizing the state of Palestine. What does it mean? Is, you know, that's really the $64,000 question. And on the one hand, you have people lauding this as a game changer. On the other, people dismissing it as a meaningless political performance, a symbolic gesture that doesn't change anything. There's something to be said for both of these points of view. And I think the key thing to understand is why these governments have now opted for recognition, and even more importantly, to keep an eye on what comes next. In my view, the reason that these governments have proceeded to recognition is very clear. They're coming under massive and growing public pressure by their own citizens to do something about the intensifying genocide in the Gaza Strip. There's been a sea change in public opinion and public perceptions among their citizens of the Middle East, and support for Palestinian rights is increasingly becoming the default view among much of their citizenry, very different to what it was 30 or 20 or in many cases even 10 years ago. These governments are all known for their alignment with Israel, and they have chosen recognition as, let's call it, the path of least resistance. They're able to do something that's very symbolic, that's very public and visible, yet without changing a single concrete policy in their relations vis-a-vis Israel. But I think it's significant for one key reason. This is not the first time that these governments have taken this or that measure in support of Palestinians or Palestinian rights. But it's important because in the past, such measures were always taken in the context of improving relations with Arab states, out of exasperation with Israeli conduct, or for some other reason. This really is the first time since the Zionist movement emerged in the late 19th century that Western governments have taken measures in support of Palestinian rights for reasons that are primarily related to pressure from their own public opinion. And that, I think, is hugely significant. And that, I think, also explains why Israel is not prepared to dismiss and mock this as a meaningless political gesture, but has had an absolute meltdown about this and is responding with total hysteria. I think they're less concerned about the actual acts of recognition than they are about why it was done and what this means for the future. Because once these governments demonstrate a willingness to capitulate to the demands of their own public opinion, who knows what could be next if this pressure continues and is intensified.
What exactly are they recognizing as Gaza disappears? The Palestinian Authority, that state you mentioned that they declared in 1988? Ben-Gvir and others in the Israeli government have pledged to dismantle the Palestinian Authority. So what precisely is the object of this recognition?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, what they are recognizing is a Palestinian state on the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, so the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And to get to straight to your question, the reasons they have given for these acts of recognition is to preserve the two-state settlement paradigm and to reinvigorate the peace process. Now, this, of course, is absolute hot air, because if you limit your action to an act of recognition, well, as you mentioned, the Gaza Strip is being reduced to rubble, a genocide is being perpetrated against its Palestinian residents, while in the West Bank, annexation is gaining pace and there's growing dispossession, settler violence, military raids, dispossession, and so on. You know, what two-state settlement? What Palestinian state? You can't recognize something and then not only do absolutely nothing to bring its proclaimed objectives about, but maintain policies that ensure its literal evaporation. But having said that, even this could increase pressure on these governments, because I don't think that those who have been campaigning for Palestinian rights are going to be satisfied with the symbolic act. You know, the next step is, okay, well, if this is your proclaimed objective, what are you going to do to make it a reality? And even more importantly, there's a much more urgent issue than any illusion of a peace process over a two-state settlement. That's a genocide. And what are you going to do about that?
Are any of the countries that have been supplying arms to Israel, other than the U.S., having second thoughts about that?
As far as I'm aware, no. I mean, we recently had a statement by Germany that it will no longer supply weapons to Israel that could be used in the Gaza Strip. Make of that what you will. How do you spell dual use? And the British have said that they have not supplied Israel with certain material. These things are so murky. One has to assume that this is all smoke and mirrors. Spain, by contrast, has formally abrogated all sales and purchases of military equipment with respect to Israel, and more recently has stated that it will no longer allow its territory to be used for transit of weapons to Israel. Some people have suggested that one shouldn't necessarily take these declarations at face value, because the U.S. Air Force uses Spanish territory as a transit point for weapons to Israel. But at the very least, the Spaniards are far ahead of many others and are willing to openly and publicly state that they will have no more military dealings with Israel, or at least as far as weapons industry is concerned. And they have, in fact, canceled several contracts to this effect.
What could these recognizing countries do as a meaningful second step after the recognition? Is there something they could do?
There's very much they can do that it's meaningful. You know, we tend to always look at this as a situation of all it takes for this genocide to end is a phone call from Washington. And while that's certainly true, that's not the only thing that can end this. Israel's main trading partner is not the United States. It's the European Union. Israel is deeply dependent upon the European market and the European economy. Israel sees itself as kind of a charter member of the West. And there's so much that can be done in terms of severing military relationships, imposing economic sanctions, replacing impunity with accountability, so legal prosecutions, not only in international courts like the International Criminal Court, but also in national courts, in terms of cultural isolation and so on, sports boycotts, that could really make life for Israel very, very sour. The situation is often compared to South Africa. I think it's quite different. I think in South Africa, the international campaign against the white minority regime, which was, of course, explicitly endorsed by the United Nations and included the suspension of Israel, of South Africa's membership in the General Assembly, I think that played an important role. But South Africa is a much bigger country, has many, many more resources than does Israel, and was able to withstand international sanctions and international isolation much better than Israel could. And it was ultimately a prolonged uprising by its own population that led the South African government, and before them the business elites, to see the light. Israel is a different kettle of fish. It is a small country with a small society that is incapable of sustaining regional domination and a forever war without the constant flow of support, not only from the United States, but from the West more generally. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently gave the speech about Israel becoming a super Sparta and adopting autarky as an economic strategy. Well, that's really not an option for Israel. And if Israel does proceed down this path in kind of an explosion of hubris, it's going to end much sooner than it did for the original Sparta.
Yeah, they couldn't possibly sustain themselves.
No, they can't. And the irony here is that this also has to do with the Oslo agreements, because it was really the so-called peace process that began in Madrid in 1991, and subsequently the Oslo process, that led to an explosion of links between the Israeli economy and the global economy. So, for example, prior to the early 1990s, Japanese and South Korean companies, on the whole, strictly observed the boycott of Israel mandated by the Arab League and had almost no relations with Israel. This is also true to a lesser extent, for example, with respect to China and India. But if you look at the drivers of the Israeli economy now, you know, the tech sector, the weapons industry, and so on, they're very, very deeply, organically tied to the global economy and really couldn't survive without it. If Israel was put into a situation such as South Africa in the 1980s, it would be a very, very different place than it is today.
Obviously, then, BDS is a mortal threat to Israel.
The key issue here is whether governments are going to be prepared to take concrete measures against Israel. BDS would certainly be an important component of this. But I think the key issue is sending a very clear message to Israel, to its leaders, that the era of unrestricted impunity is coming to an end and is going to be replaced by an era of accountability, because there's an organic relationship between what Israel does and what it is allowed to do. The longer the leash it is given, the more ferocious it will bite at anything within range of its fangs. And so I think the key issue is, of course, you know, concrete policy changes, including those promoted by the BDS movement. But I think the key issue is a transformation of attitudes to Israel, making clear to Israel that the double standards are coming to an end. You are going to be judged by the same criteria that applies to any other state in your position. No more exceptions.
I noticed that Israel the other day told IDF veterans, that's pretty much the whole population, to be careful about what they say when they travel abroad. That was an interesting confession of vulnerability, it seemed. Like, they're getting very worried that their people could suffer real serious sanctions internationally.
Yes, and unfortunately, those fears have not yet been made very real for most of these people. But here again, you know, we get to my earlier point about the organic relationship between what Israel does and what it is allowed to do. Because Israel is held to an entirely different standard than every other country on this planet and is allowed to do what it wants with total impunity, whereas any other country would suffer real consequences for doing this. You have this strange phenomenon of soldiers actively participating in a genocide and openly bragging about it on social media, you know, posting pictures, posting videos, gloating and celebrating their atrocities. And it is in this context, I think, that these advisories are going out from the Israeli government and military leadership to soldiers. Unfortunately, thus far, it is primarily an issue of Israel acting out of an abundance of caution. We need to go to a situation where those fears are made very real, because real action is undertaken against criminals visiting foreign soil. I mean, we have, you know, just to give one example, we have the case of the Israeli prime minister, who's a fugitive from international justice, who was wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court, but was allowed to use the airspace of three signatories to the Rome Statute, Greece, Italy, and France, on several occasions to attend to his latest victory tour in Washington. So these three governments have effectively renounced the Rome Statute and are in flagrant violation of their obligations towards the International Criminal Court. It is these kinds of things, exceptions made for Israel that would be made for no other country. This is a transformation that needs to happen. These are the changes that are necessary.
I'm speaking with the journalist Muin Rabbani. These recognitions imply a belief in a future two-state solution. The two-state solution seems pretty dead. Am I wrong, or is it just sleeping deeply, or is it really dead, dead, dead?
No, it's a complete sham, and I think it's become a completely hollow and empty slogan. First and foremost, because those who proclaim the slogan most loudly have consistently refused to do anything at all to bring it about. They have never imposed consequences on Israel for its systematic efforts to ensure that no Palestinian state can be established. And now they're left holding the bag and proclaiming these hollow and empty slogans for which they have no one to blame but themselves. And I think priority now should be to call them out on this. The chimera of the peace process, the illusion of a two-state settlement during the 1990s, was consistently invoked as a fig leaf, as smoke and mirrors, to avoid directly addressing what Israel was concretely doing on the ground. Typically, you know, Israel would build a new settlement, and Western governments, when called upon to confront Israel about this, would respond, well, yes, it's wrong, but we can't do anything because it will endanger the peace process, which is the ultimate objective, so we have to grin and bear it. That won't fly anymore. Quite apart from the broader discussion about whether there can or should be peace with a genocidal apartheid regime, but I think the key issue now is not to allow these governments to continue invoking hollow and empty slogans, which they do nothing to bring about in reality, as a fig leaf to do nothing about the really urgent issues unfolding on the ground.
Now, if the possibility of a two-state solution seems very, very remote, Israel seems still to take it seriously. Their anxiety and outrage at these recognitions suggests that they do fear it someday. Why do they care so much if this is dead, dead, dead?
I don't think Israel's fears are so much about a two-state settlement. I think Israel's fears are about the changing international environment. Support for Israel has traditionally been an electoral asset. Support for Palestinian rights has traditionally been a political death sentence. That's beginning to change.
It's remarkable we're seeing this in New York City now, which, you know, has historically been the hotbed of Zionism, and now the likely next mayor is a firm supporter of Palestinian rights, not in a mealy-mouthed way, but a serious way.
I don't think either of us ever expected to see anything remotely like this during our lifetimes, or perhaps even during our children's lifetimes. And here it is happening in real time. In election after election, we're seeing that candidates are no longer terrified of speaking out openly in support of Palestinian rights. They may not necessarily win, but the idea that they had to conceal these views and express them only in private, those days are over. You have now, you know, last year, a advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice that the continued Israeli rule of the occupied territories is illegal and must be brought to an end as rapidly as possible, and imposed all kinds of obligations on member states about their dealings with Israel and its occupation. You have the genocide case before the ICJ. You have the indictments of Israeli officials at the International Criminal Court. And now with these recognitions, at least in theory, you have a situation that is more akin to the 1990 Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, of one state occupying another. And that can and should have all kinds of consequences. Whether it will or not, time will tell. But my suspicion is that those whose activism, whose campaigns have brought us to this point, are not going to pack up and go home because of this symbolic measure that has been taken by some Western governments, but rather will see an opportunity and intensify and expand their campaigns. And I think that is the real fear, the justified fear that Israel has, because again, this is the first time since this issue first emerged during the late 19th century that Western governments have taken measures in support of Palestinian rights as a result of public pressure by their own citizens.
It's darkly amusing to see Smotrich the other day coming off like some sort of anti-colonialist. He said the days when the UK and other countries determined our future are over. The British mandate has ended. That's a lot of chutzpah for a country utterly dependent upon big powers, notably the US. Do they really believe this?
Yeah. You go back in history and you have explicit statements by British officials that their support of the Zionist movement at the time was basically to establish what they openly referred to as a Jewish Ulster in Palestine, in the Middle East, as a proxy. And Israel's very survival, in my view, is dependent on its function as a Western proxy in the Middle East. But Israel specializes in self-glorification in this view, not that it is dependent on the West, but that the West is dependent on Israel.
Yeah, it's out there defending Western values.
Exactly. And it has some, you know, support in this view. So you had, for example, during its attack on Iran, the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz saying Israel is doing the dirty work for all of us. And of course, the far right in Europe and North America very much shares this view that if it weren't for Israel, the entire West would become a province of a global Islamic caliphate and all the rest of it. Yes, but, you know, Israeli leaders have been allowed to become full of themselves and believe that they are the ones in the driver's seat, not the ox pulling the cart.
Meanwhile, the extremists in the Israeli cabinet, like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are now barely distinguishable from Netanyahu himself, are calling for the annexation of the West Bank, either in whole or in part. Trump says he won't allow it, for what that's worth. But what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's a very good question and remains unclear. There was a meeting in New York on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly yesterday between Trump and a bunch of leaders from the Arab world and several Muslim countries, in which Trump apparently pledged that he would prevent Israel from annexing West Bank territory. That probably means there's going to be some kind of authorization to Israel to do this. Israel doesn't have any easy options here. It feels it cannot do nothing in response to this spate of recognitions. Simply denouncing its allies who have recognized Palestine as anti-Semites and jihadists operating as Hamas agents and so on is going to be insufficient. Yes, it can close down embassies and consulates and so on, but that's akin to Israel shooting itself in the foot, although if Israel in its current state of hubris understands this, is less clear. And its other option is to annex, formally, you know, it is annexing territory, but here to jettison the caution and gradualism of previous Israeli governments, the process that was known as creeping annexation, and to give in to its own instincts and conduct a formal annexation of perhaps some settlements, all settlements, Area C, which constitutes some 60% of the West Bank, or even of the West Bank in its entirety. And certainly the European Union and European governments have consistently stated that annexation constitutes a red line which will not go unanswered. And then you will get a very interesting situation, because I think Europe's instincts are to pretend that nothing happened in order to continue with business as usual. And certainly Brussels will go out of its way to pretend there's no crisis that demands a response. That will be the moment of truth for public opinion, which has brought us to this point. Will they then have sufficient power and influence to compel governments to put their money where their mouth is, and to treat a red line like a red line rather than an amber light? Or will governments be able to finesse this issue and do nothing?
And finally, Israel is really in the final stages of physically destroying Gaza. There's not going to be anything left to this territory very soon. They've effectively rendered 2 million people homeless. What next?
Well, you're now seeing all these day-after scenarios, you know, with the typical cast of characters, you know, Tony Blair, Jared Kushner, various shady Israeli figures, and so on. And they're putting forward all these plans to make the Gaza Strip another Dubai on the Mediterranean, and so on. And in my view, these proposals are all really camouflage fig leaves meant to promote the expulsion of the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip. Now that Egypt and other Arab governments have been absolutely clear that they will not participate in the ethnic cleansing of the Gaza Strip, the idea now is to provide cash incentives to Palestinians to get out and not come back. I doubt that is going to work very successfully either.
Yeah, they have absolutely nowhere to go. I mean, it's not a moment where the world is welcoming refugees with open arms.
Well, exactly. So you have, for example, the far right in Europe, you know, on the one hand, applauding every new Israeli atrocity and demanding that the Gaza Strip become Israeli territory, while also being absolutely clear they refuse to accept a single Palestinian within their own borders. And of course, this has not ended, so we don't know how it will end. But my suspicion is that Israel, when it recognizes it doesn't have any option for mass forcible expulsion the way it did in 1948, to a lesser extent in 1967, will opt for a situation similar to that which you had in Syria the previous decade, where life is simply made so intolerable for those in the territory that they do whatever they can in order to remain alive and provide a future.
But they're essentially walled in at this point.
They're essentially walled in. So you will get, you know, a situation where people will try to either bribe their way into Egypt, get into dinghies in order to go to Cyprus or whatever. And of course, large numbers will die in the process. But here Israel has another challenge. Typically, when people seek refuge from war zones or extreme poverty or what have you, they do so in the knowledge that they can always come back when the situation changes. With Palestinians, the situation is very different. Departure is always a one-way ticket. And once you're out forever. And so the question becomes, to what extent will Palestinians, with this knowledge, nevertheless feel that they have no choice but to be ethnically cleansed from their homeland and accept it? And to what extent will this prevent them from seeking opportunities abroad? Those are unanswered questions, but the situation in Gaza clearly is intolerable, and left to Israel will only get worse.
I'm sure if we're up to Israel, they would just let him die, but I'm not sure they can get away with that at this point, but who knows?
when you begin to have these spread of communicable diseases, of non-fatal infections that cause deaths because of the destruction of the health sector and the unavailability of basic drugs and so on, you could have very large numbers of deaths for which Israel, you know, will claim not only that it has nothing to do with this, but that it is Israel and not the Palestinians who are the victims here.
That was Moin Rabbani, co-editor of Jot Aliyah. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Al Barak, new from friend of Behind the News and fellow Brooklynite Bergsonist. It's named after a high-speed rail line that runs between Casablanca and Tangier in her native Morocco. You can find it at Bandcamp. Next, Argentina. In December 2023, the radical libertarian Javier Milei became president of Argentina. He campaigned with a chainsaw, which he promised to take to the government. He gave Elon Musk one to do similar in Washington. Milei, who loves to quote right-wing icons like Hayek and Rothbard, savaged government spending, and now he's in trouble. Inflation may be down, but the economy is in the tank, and Milei and his party are deeply unpopular. So the U.S. Treasury is about to extend a $20 billion lifeline. Can't have a Trump hero fail. Here with more is Ernesto Saman. Saman is an associate professor in the Foreign Languages Department at the University of Bergen in Norway. His excellent overview article about Milei in the New York Review of Books from March 2024 is worth tracking down. In the passage where Saman is talking about the central bank's move to keep the price down, he's referring to the use of dollars out of its reserves to buy pesos to support the currency's value. Since Argentina imports so many essentials, most of them priced in dollars, a decline in the value of the peso raises domestic prices, and that increase in inflation and erosion in the value of peso-denominated savings presents serious economic and political problems. Ernesto Saman.
It looks like a rich irony of the libertarian Javier Milei's government needing a U.S. Treasury bailout. We have now Scott Bessent, Treasury Secretary, sounding like the ECB president, European Central Bank president, Mario Draghi, in 2012, to do whatever it takes to end the euro crisis. I'm not sure Hayek would approve of this. How did the Argentine economy end up in a situation where it needs a swap line now from the U.S. Treasury?
We are in October, in September, so it's like 4 months after it needed another one of $20 billion also, the last loan from the IMF, also to along the same lines to prevent excessive volatility. What happened, I think there's this political and economic reasons as always. Politically, I think the U.S. moved forcefully because it perceives Milei power in Argentina as a sort of a test for the far right and right wing governments in the Americas in general, and consider Milei a strategic asset in the Americas. Trump is of course, we all know, is erratic, to say the least. But if there is something that Trump and Trumpism, or whatever you want to call that, has been non-erratic at all and quite consistent, has been in the strategic alliance with the far right in Latin America, with former President Bolsonaro in Brazil, with Milei in Argentina, and with Bukele in Salvador. There's no mistakes there. There's nothing ambivalent and no back and forth. There's always clear who are on his side, what is at stake, and what the enemies are. And out of the three of them, Milei seems to be a leading case because Bolsonaro is not in power, and Argentina is a much larger country than El Salvador. And I think what happened was that on September 7, like 2 weeks ago, the elections in the Buenos Aires province district, which is the largest in Argentina, delivered like a strong support for the Peronist government of the province and an equally sound defeat to Milei. His party lost for, I think, 13 points. And so with very persistent inflation that they have not been able to totally control, and the economy frozen at the same time, so the mounting social tensions found, it seems, some form of electoral expression in a return to Peronism. After that, the 10 days following that election, the government was in such a disarray that the following days after the elections, the comments were from how bad the defeat would be for the national midterm elections, which are a month from today on October 26, to wondering actually if the government was going to make it to October, or if Milei was going to be able to stay in power until then. As it happens, most of the times in Argentina, in times of uncertainty, businesses and individuals seek shelter for their savings in dollars. Because of that, the price rose steadily for a week, forced the central bank to sell reserves to keep the prices down. The last Friday before they started this conversation with the Trump administration, the central bank sold $1 billion in a single day to keep the price down. So basically what happens is that it avoids an immediate collapse of the Milei administration. So far, the only thing we have up to now is a print of the tweet that Trump sent about Milei. So we really don't have the details about what's going to happen. By we, I mean most of the world. I'm not sure the Argentine government knows more than that. But we think that it's true that there might be a swap for $20 billion, another $20 billion. It means that it will be enough money to, first, to stop an immediate currency run by selling more dollars to keep the prices down. It might help the government to stay afloat until the elections in October, right? It will not have a translation, I think, in the long run either, but from now to the election, it will not have an impact in the social landscape in general. It's not going to reduce unemployment in 4 weeks. It's not going to reduce poverty in 4 weeks. So it remains to be seen the kind of effect that is going to have immediately. But it might calm down the public conversation and allow Milei to face the elections in a less dramatic way than what it was 4 or 5 days ago.
He took office in December 2023. What did he do to bring us to this sorry pass here? What were his policies? What did he do once taking office? It's been quite a radical program.
It's been an open, aggressive, and forceful dismantling of government intervention in the economy, the deregulation of foreign trade, in some cases both things slower than what the most radical parts of the government wanted, but in all cases much more dramatic than what had been done before in Argentine history. Milei, during the campaign, entertained the idea for closing the central bank and adopting the U.S. dollar as the national currency, right? So if you compare to those kind of statements, he didn't do enough for the ultra-libertarian supporters, but he did basically freeze most of fiscal spending, reduced budgets in every single area of the government, including education, that led to some of the most important rallies against his administration during the last couple of months by universities and high school students, reduced the public employees in significant numbers as well, and also worked in Elon Musk, eliminating all the regulations that, according to his ideas, don't allow for a freer economy that would actually benefit everybody. So that's been the basic tasks of these 2 years.
Libertarianism, and Milei professes to be a libertarian, you know, he's quoting Hayek and Murray Rothbard and all those characters. The libertarianism doesn't necessarily come with civil liberties. There's a curious affinity between libertarianism and authoritarianism. And in Milei's case, his vice president comes out of a family with deep military and intelligence ties. He has been quite authoritarian himself. So what about civil liberties under Milei?
That's probably what we need to pay attention to when we talk about the far right as a regional movement, because it would be easier based on his idea, embracing a libertarian economy, to see the differences with Trump. One working towards a more open economy, dismantling every form of regulation and protections. The other one working towards a form of protectionist economy or nationalist economy in the case of Trump. But I think in both cases, and in the case of Bolsonaro as well, there's a common concern about, how did he call that in the tweet that he sent yesterday? The radical left. There's a common concern about the progressive policies that might become in any way a challenge to the status quo. That in the case of Argentina is represented in different and conflicting ways by Peronism.
What does Peronism mean in the Argentine political context?
Peronism and populism as an ideology or as an idea means a movement towards the expansion of citizenship and rights for those disenfranchised, mostly but not only in economic terms, and has been quite consistent, that kind of embrace of Peronism during the Kirchner years from 2003 to 2015. It's very easy to disregard populism as too vague of an idea, but in 2019, the end of the first right-wing administration, in that case by neoliberal president Mauricio Macri, there was a conversation on the phone, June 2019, between then President Bolsonaro and then President Trump during his first term. And at some point, Trump asked Bolsonaro, "What can the U.S. do for Brazil?" And Bolsonaro says, "The best the U.S. can do is to help Macri to win the re-election and to stop the rise of populism in Argentina." We might discuss what Peronism means and what populism means as an ideology, whether Trump or Bolsonaro are populist or not, but they have a very clear idea of what it means as a threat. I think in that sense, the idea, and I guess it's the same domestically in the U.S., the idea of an enemy, imaginary or not, as a challenge for the restoration of a status quo works as a galvanizing force for the far right more effectively than pretty much anything else. Trump is very well connected with the political process in Latin America. Again, I'm going back to what I said at the beginning. There's a few places and few things in the U.S. foreign policy that are during the Trump administration that are more consistent than what he's doing in Latin America.
I'm speaking with Ernesto Samón, Associate Professor in the Foreign Languages Department at the University of Bergen in Norway.
The Argentine upper class never particularly liked Peronism, but the working classes turned against it and helped bring Milei to power. Neoliberalism from below, to quote Veronica Gecko's title. What brought about that shift of opinion among the working class and the poor? Why did they turn to support Milei?
It might be too soon to tell, because we need to see the end of the story and the elections in October, but it seems two things. I would say, long run and short run. In the short run, people in the U.S., in the moon, and in Argentina vote within the available options and not the options that we want them to have. And the only one that they had in hand to punish the Peronist Party in 2023 was Milei. Does not mean that 56% of the population deeply believed everything that was represented in Milei's victory. In the longer run, that Peronism, much as all the other progressive movements in Latin America, have faced the challenge of having a sort of a progressive administration of a neoliberal state and a neoliberal social formation. So in so many ways during those 12 years, even though I'm not saying that they're all the same, but in so many ways, the Kirchner administration from 2003 to 2015, managed to redistribute resources to empower those disenfranchised, not only the unemployed and the poor, and as you mentioned, but also expanding civil rights in ways, unprecedented ways in Argentina, as it happened in other countries in the Americas, but at the same time unable to radically change the subordination of workers and the poor to this wealth that you mentioned at the beginning. Inequality remains high. People had access to housing policies, but people living in slums, you can count them in the millions in Argentina. Kirchnerismo made a variety of efforts to expand public education and to make sure that people had access to that education, and that is true. But at the same time, public education remains lower quality than the private one. Same thing with the health system. Same thing with the environment. It's not the same policy the libertarian government is embracing in relation to extractivism and natural resources, but the truth is that there was one common agreement among all the political forces in the 2023 election, the most ideologically polarized election in Argentine history, was the idea that the only way out of the economic decline was by expanding extractive practices from the agricultural sector to mining to energy. So I mentioned this, as I mentioned health and education and housing before. Those efforts for progressive reforms have always been constrained within the neoliberal structures in Latin America had in place at least since the late 1970s. And that is politically difficult to support in the long run. So I think that one reason, going back to your question, why people actually shift from Peronism to Milei, or some people did that, was the expectation of something radically new that would leave that kind of ambivalent shortcomings behind. The extent to which they did that ideologically convinced of that, I think that's what remains to be seen. It seems that volatility in political terms might be more of an explanatory force now than big ideological changes. And you have to consider that in Argentina, the last government that was able to go for re-election successfully was in 2011. So the Kirchner Peronism lost in 2015, then Macri lost in 2019, and then the Peronism came back and lost in 2023. So there seems to be a high degree of volatility, and that's why I said that it's probably too soon to tell.
Peronists seem to be suffering from the same thing that center-left parties around the world have been suffering from, like trying to maintain some modest degree of progressive social policies. At the same time, they're really constrained by a broadly neoliberal structure, overarching structure to their policies. This does seem to be a worldwide problem.
It is a worldwide problem, yeah. Part of the conversation in Argentina in the months after the rise of Milei to power was to try to figure out what were the shortcomings of the Kirchner administration that made that possible. Maybe they didn't fight enough against the inflation that remained particularly high, as you mentioned. Maybe they disregarded politically the pessimism of the lower and the lower middle class. And that might be true, but the reality is, as you say, that, you know, countries that in which governments were particularly concerned and were successful in bringing inflation down also had a rise of the far right. And the Kirchners were not particularly in the last 2 years effective at controlling fiscal deficit, but in countries that they did control fiscal deficit, they also had a rise of the far right. So when you put together Spain, Brazil, Argentina, Norway, where the far right just made their best election in history, very different economic configurations and very different political approaches by progressive labor and or populist forces have not stopped the far right from keep growing. So there might be something else. What is different in Argentina, if I compare that with the three countries that I just mentioned randomly, is that in Argentina, Milei actually won. This might change very quickly. In Chile, elections are 2 months from now, November 16, and the progressive government of Gabriel Boric is facing a four-way election between the candidate from the government, Jara from the Communist Party, a candidate from the right, a candidate from the far right, and a candidate from the far, far right. This is literally that. Matei, Kast, and Kaiser. They're quite successful economically. Copper prices are high. With the domestic currency down, they have become much more competitive. Social indicators are all improving. Inflation is sort of under control. Fiscal deficit as well. There they are, about to see which variety, which shade of the right is going to get to power. So there seems to be something else in line with what you are saying. There's some problem about how to succeed in a progressive way of handling a neoliberal structure, which is the, I guess, historically we can say that has been the solution or the way progressive forces tried when revolutionary movements failed. So the options were the experience of the oldest generation from Boric, which is the youngest one, to the Kirchner, Cristina Kirchner, who might be around 70 now, their old sons and daughters of the experiences of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, and that, you know, have not ended the way many of us wanted. It's historically easy to understand why reformism became an alternative towards the turn of the century, but I think it might be showing its shortcomings now, and not because some specific economic policies or lack of control over inflation in the short run, as it was the case of the Kirchners in Argentina.
That was Ernesto Samán, Associate Professor in the Foreign Languages Department at the University of Bergen, Norway. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some music by Argentina's most famous composer, Alberto Ginastera, performed by Argentina's most famous pianist, Martha Argerich. This is the opening of the third of his Argentinian dances, Opus 2, The Dance of the Artful Herdsman. It was his first published composition, written at 21 while still a conservatory student. Till next week, bye.